Well, hello, and welcome to Calgary, where the Line Podcast is taping its first ever before a live studio audience episode. I'm Matt Gurney. Jen Gerson is here with me. We're going to talk budget. We're going to talk ArriveCan. We will probably do a bit of an Israel update, which I'm sure will be very popular. All that and more on the latest, but also first live episode of the Line Podcast. I'm bringing these people home with me. When I'm doing this on Zoom in my basement, I need that kind of energy. I should mention my basement flooded this week. It doesn't smell good, but you know what? You can all come over anyway. You and the rats are welcome in my basement anytime.
Firstly, Matt, before we get going, I would like to give a special thanks to the sponsor of this event, DS Lawyers. Go talk to that woman down there, and if you want to know how good a lawyer they are, please hit us up at the meet and greet. We can tell you all kinds of stories. We are their favorite clients. It's true, as you might imagine. But they are sponsoring this event tonight, so please do consider them if you have any particular legal needs.
Also, hi, Lindsay. I didn't see you before, but hi. Yeah, hi. guys, look, we've laid out the broad topics here, and as I've already said, we will do a Q&A. We'll do that off the record after. We'll stop the recording. I guess we start with the budget this week, and Jen, you and your family had a stomach virus sweep through you guys on the weekend. My house was flooding.
Yeah.
This was like the worst possible week to get like hundreds of pages of like charts dropped on us. Like neither of us wanted to go read these things. So basically,
I'm only holding myself up with copious amounts of drugs and pure will at the moment.
She leaves what drugs unspecified?
yes, I do.
So in terms of the budget, like I don't know if I want to respond to it as a policy document because that just makes me sad. Having to read all the policy elements just bums me out. But let me ask you a political question.
Got it.
Does anyone care about anything that's in the budget except for stuff they want to fight about on Twitter? Like, is there one person out there who's yeah, I didn't want to vote for Justin Trudeau, but because of page 712.
But because of his brilliant dental plan, I mean, my diabetes medication might be more covered than it would. I mean, no, I don't think that the budget turns around any particular narrative for him. I do think that my highlights of the budget were threefold. One thing they were noticing was of course, the capital gains tax stuff that they were talking about. The housing announcements, which, I mean, to some extent have been ripped off from the conservative platform on housing. And then the other thing that I thought personally was interesting was chatter about the degree to which Canada's pension programs and potentially CPP will be required to reinvest back in Canadian companies. These were the three things that flagged for me. The capital gains tax increase. Now, I'm not going to go into great details about the capital gains tax increase, but essentially, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's something like every capital gains over $250,000 will be now taxed at something like, 66% as opposed to 50%?
Yeah.
The inclusion rate change.
Right.
Okay, there we go.
It's your marginal tax rate, but before, sorry, I think I'm really popping here.
Yeah, we're having some popping here.
We can just turn that down a bit, or I can just hold it further away. You guys can still hear okay? I'll just hold the mic a bit further away. Basically, you're still taxed at your marginal rate, but before 50% of your capital gain was tax-free, now it's 33.3% gain is tax-free. So depending on the actual asset you're selling, it could be a relatively marginal amount of money, but obviously the larger the capital gain, the more extra tax you end up paying.
Okay, so let's talk about the politics of this first. Because the politics of this is designed to try and back the conservatives into a position where they're defending the rich, right? They're trying to say, we're going after the rich to make sure they pay their fair share for all of these programs that we want to put in place. So they're hoping that the conservatives take that bait and say that this capital gains tax is bad for investments. The liberals can then go and say, look at these dudes. They're not out for you. They're out for their rich banker buddies, blah, 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 blah. That, I think, is the obvious political play on the capital gains tax. Is the capital gains change to the inclusion rate, is this good policy or is it bad policy? Does it affect as few people as the liberals say it is? I think the liberals have said something like it will only wind up affecting something like 40,000 Canadians. We're talking about the richest of the rich. I find that number a little bit suspect because I think that you're going to find a lot of people, for example, who inherited a family cottage, having to sell that cottage out 1 year, wind up having to pay a whole extra boatload of taxes on the family cottage and significantly reduce their familial wealth as a result of this. So I don't think it's just going to hit the wealthiest of the wealthiest. I think that there are going to be lots of middle-class families who are going to have like these one-time expenses. For example, maybe they had to sell out their small business 1 year and they get hit on stuff like this. So I think that it is a bit of an issue on that. But the most compelling take that I found on the capital gains tax was actually a tweet by Adam McNamara, I believe, who I think is a VP at Spotify. And if my phone hadn't died, I'd pull up the tweet directly. But he said something to the effect of Canada is just a ridiculous, uncompetitive three oligopolies in a trench coat. It's horrendously unproductive. It's got all kinds of competition issues. And you're going after exactly the tier of wealth that the country needs to attract in order to become more innovative and more competitive on the global stage. That's the actual issue. Yes, we get that the average person doesn't have a lot of sympathy for the people who are making running businesses that are $5 to $20 million revenue. But it's those companies that are making the $5 to $20 million revenue that are going to actually, I say this, they're not big enough to be protected like a Rogers or a Bell, but they are small, and they're small enough to still be potentially innovative and doing hiring and doing some of the interesting things that could allow them to grow and create real wealth for the country. And by targeting them specifically, it's just a weird place to put your thumb on the lever. These are the sorts of people you want in the country. You want these people to be highly motivated to invest here and grow their wealth here. But I understand that that is a really unsympathetic argument to make to an average population. That's like, dude, I can't afford to kill the rats on my Toronto property.
It does get expensive. I have 2 points to make about this, and one of them is a little bit tangential to the tax itself, but it's something that pops up. And look, I agree with Jen. Part of it is tactical. This is putting the conservatives in a position where everything they say is going to get spun into a liberal attack ad of, oh, see, they don't stand up for you. They're standing up for their rich corporate buddies, right? We've already seen a bit of that, like when the liberals, about a month or so ago, they were hammering Pierre Poilievre's chief of staff, Jenny Byrne. They were hammering her for being a lobbyist for Loblaws, right? Because, ooh, evil Loblaws. I always thought that was a stupid strategy. I don't think the liberals actually have anything to gain from getting a who's lobbying for who battle going. I think there's a degree of mutually assured destruction if they go down that path. But it was obviously targeting the rich, and I get it. That's as good populist fodder. Whether it's the small business owner who has built a business up enough where he can sell it and actually realize that, exceed the lifetime exemption, which I think is now $1.25 million, which did rise in this budget. Or as Jen said, it's the person selling the cottage. No one out there is going to go, oh man, I feel terrible for the cottage owners. Like, that's not a political constituency in this country. So I get it. But one of the things that just pisses me off is that the messaging being used by the government this week was actually directly echoing 2015. Those first Justin Trudeau walking up the escalator ads that I think a lot of you will remember, or there was like a one where he's doing like a walk and talk video and he's saying, we're going to ask the very richest among us to pay a little bit more. And the language being used this week was almost verbatim identical to the language being used 9 or 10 years ago. And then on a radio panel I was doing, just on a local Toronto radio station, I was paired with a really smart person. I like her a lot, but she is affiliated with the NDP, and she had raised the question of, I want the rich to just pay their fair share. Okay, I do too. Can someone please tell me what that is? And I know this is going to be spun as the Matt Gurney and the line defending the rich. I'm not defending the rich. Let's make them pay their fair share. I just want someone to tell me what that is. And then we can figure out how to do that, because it seems to me when we talk about making the rich pay their fair share, what we really mean is, oh shit, our poll numbers went down last month. Let's go talk about making the rich pay their fair share. And no one, like, I don't know how you build a tax system which is designed in theory to raise the revenues we need to provide the services we choose to have, when your goal of the taxation policy is like revenue raising and also like vibes.
Well, and I would say to that, the other interesting thing is, I think that there's something trickier going on here where you have a lot of people in Canada who are deeply stressed on groceries and housing. And there are some people who are going to be very sympathetic to the idea of projecting those ills on the rich. It's not that monetary policy or housing policy or all these issues are directly leading to my difficulties. No, rather it's those rich are just taking too much of the pie, right? So it becomes this weird projection kind of element, and that's not really how wealth works.
But I would say I do agree with that, but I think that can actually go two ways, because one of the things that, and I think polling would back this up, so the Liberals are saying the number they're using is that this capital gains tax increase applies to 0.13% of the population, about 40,000 Canadians in total. Statistically speaking, none of you in the room are likely to qualify for that. We don't have enough people in the room to find that one person. But everyone has aspirations of being rich. And for some of us, it's realistic. Not a lot of us, but for some of us. So the impact of a tax policy is never just felt by those it is going to affect today. It is also going to be felt by the people who think to myself, you know what, if things go well for me, that could be me in 5 years. So I think that's an issue. But I think, Jen, to the point you raised about this landing disproportionately on that really economically productive...
Yeah, the super rich are always going to be able to find a way around these kinds of tax gains. This is like if you're making $100 to $500 million a year, if you're, you know, the CEO of I don't know, pick a major Bombardier, like this ain't really going to touch you, because you're going to find a way to around the tax system to get you. The sort of people who are going to get nailed by this are going to be the people who are in companies or owning companies that are making like the $5, $10, $15, $20 million a year. And again, I get that these people aren't sympathetic. I understand that. I understand when Tech Bro gets on Twitter and says this is an anti-innovative policy. You're just like, screw you, Tech Bro. I can't pay my rent. I get that. But bluntly, like, if you want to make Canada a more competitive, more open economy as opposed to one that's increasingly dependent on government largesse and government handouts, what I have called in the past the octopus economy, you need more of the tech bros than the big oligarchic sort of major Uber corporations that are making significant profit off of essentially forms of regulatory capture, right?
I'm trying to think of the least weird way to say this, but I actually know personally some of the people who are going to be wealthy enough to be the explicit public target of this kind of a policy. Like, I'm not going to name names here, but I know the people who would be like, oh yeah, who cares if so-and-so's taxes go up like marginally here. And I was just texting some of them after the budget. I'm like, what do you think about this? And without fail, they said, we planned for this years ago. We're not going to pay an extra cent of this tax. Like, we have structured our businesses, our family trusts, our corporations in a way where of course we knew the government eventually was going to come after us on capital gains. Of course we knew eventually there will probably be either an official or a de facto wealth tax or an inheritance tax or even a primary residence tax. The Liberals have gone out of their way to say they won't do that, but sooner or later, look around at the amount of money in this country locked up in real estate, look at the state of the healthcare system, and do the math. Sooner or later, someone will reach for that as a tax. And the people who would be the most juicy political targets for this, they were ready for it 20 or 30 years ago, and they've structured their entire life accordingly. It's the new guy who had the interesting idea 10 years ago.
Well, and I was just going to say Matt and I come into $1 million or $2 million and want to invest in a company, for example, or grow our current company. We have to now have a conversation. Well, where's the best place for us to do that? Where can we be most competitive in that, right? So,
shout out to the local audience. We're incorporated in Alberta for a reason.
We are.
Like the Line is an Alberta-based corporation because when we were starting it, we looked around and we're like, yeah.
I mean, I also live here, so that's legit, but...
No, but it was just, okay, where is the most tax-efficient way to do that? At the scale the Line is at now, like, subscribe, donate, tell your friends today, etc., we don't need to rethink that.
No, we're not. We're definitely not rich enough to be worried about this just yet. But
in theory, we would probably today make a different decision. And what I find fascinating about this as well is one of the reasons the Line exists And one of the reasons we're so happy to see all of you here, and it is, you've probably all gone blind to it. I doubt you even see it anymore, but at the bottom of every article we publish is our mission statement. And one of the key lines in that is that we reject bullshit. We will not always be right. We will get things wrong. We will piss you off, but we will never lie to you. Whenever you disagree with us, we're telling you our sincere thoughts. And one of the things that I find really frustrating about this is that the reaction on this issue on both sides this week has been bullshit. And you have the people who are delighted by this basically saying it's not going to hurt productivity. It's only 40,000 Canadians and those awful cottage
owners.
What's
left of it?
and then on the other side, of course, you have the detractors who are going, it's going to be a stampede of capital for the border. Everyone with a net value of more than $30 will be living in Florida by the end of the week. No, and that's wrong too. But what it's going to do is it's going to start changing decisions around the margins. And if you are a reasonably successful Canadian business person, or if, I know
you
this is-
You aspire to be them.
Or, you know, even a sadder situation, just for instance, you know, your elderly folks pass away and you inherit their property in Toronto, you sell it for like $250 million. What are you going to do with that money?
You going to reinvest it in Canada?
Probably not now. And, or at least fewer people will. And what struck me as amazing about this is not that I think tweaking the inclusion rate on capital gains tax is going to torpedo the economy, but it's how there seems to be a refusal by the government to acknowledge that every policy choice will have a trade-off. And if they were just going to admit that and say, look, yeah, this is going to slow down investment in this, it might result in some money flowing out of the country, but we think on balance we'll make more than we lose, and we also think this is fair, I would go, okay. We can agree with it or not, but at least that would be an honest answer. It seems to me our political landscape today is either, and we've talked about this before, everything is either the best idea ever, which will have precisely zero unintended consequences, or it will actually destroy the country.
On that note, like, subscribe, and eat the rich.
Eat the rich, yeah.
Okay, a couple other things I did want to touch on. One, housing and pension policy. Housing, I do think that, okay, can I just say, of all of the Liberal ministers, and I realize I'm damning by faint praise, of all the Liberal ministers, I think one of the strongest today has been Sean Fraser, who's had been front on the file on housing, seems to have actually recognized that housing is a crucial issue in Canada, many years too late, but we're getting there. And in this budget, there was a real attempt to address housing and to try, I think, to inoculate the Liberals going into the next election on something that has rapidly become the Conservatives, what I would call sword issue. Do I need to explain shield and sword issues?
A shield issue is something that helps you protect your own base. A sword issue is something that lets you go out and flip the other guy's voters to your side.
Yeah, so in the course of, I think, about a year and a half, we've gone from the Liberals making housing a part of their, in 2015, the Liberals made housing a part of their platform, but a year and a half, the Liberals realized that was too hard and had Trudeau come out and say, hey, you know, housing's not really a federal jurisdiction. The backlash to that was significant, and since then we've had Sean Fraser, who I think is, again, one of the more competent ministers, come out and say, okay, well, yeah, no, it's actually a major issue and we're going to actually start addressing it. So they've been working with Mike Moffitt on a housing strategy. They've been making tweaks to things like GS tax or GST on I think building. Is it building?
They're incentivizing the construction of rental apartments, yeah, because the economic payback on that has typically been lower. So if you change the tax incentive, it becomes kind, sure, of a break-even proposition.
Cool. And then in the budget, there were three major announcements, to my mind, about housing. One is a plan to build sort of 3.9 million houses by 2031. That is the correct number. That is about the number we need to be building if we're going to bring in immigration at the rate that we're bringing in, correct. And in about that time frame, that is significantly more houses than we have ever built in this country in anything resembling a time frame like that in the past. But at least we're getting an understanding of the scope of the problem. In other words, you had the Liberals saying that they were going to be selling out or leasing public land. I thought that was very funny because that seemed to have been taken directly from the Conservatives' line on this. And then the other one is that you had the Liberals saying that they were going to start to tie housing building to transit infrastructure. So this saying, oh, municipality, you like your transit infrastructure funding. Well, that's great. Let me see your housing plan for that transit infrastructure. That is a slightly watered down version of, I think, of what the Conservatives have planned. The Conservatives are being far more aggressive in their attempts to basically bribe municipalities into bulldozering over their NIMBYs and get stuff built. But essentially, they're taking a lot of their cues directly from conservative planning. And actually, I applaud that. I think parties should be quite shameless about stealing good ideas from other parties. And I think that's fantastic. I don't know whether this is going to be enough to inoculate the Liberals from the fact that they've been in power for 9 years and the housing situation's only gone from bad to worse in that time. I don't think we're going to see the turnaround that we need to see as rapidly as we need to see it in order to... I don't think we're going to see the housing situation turn around as quickly as we're going to need to see it for the Liberals to rebuild trust on that particular file. So I don't necessarily think it's going to be successful. But it's very interesting and at least, I think, somewhat heartening for me to see the Liberals recognize finally the depth of that problem.
Let's just do the math. And this is actually easy to do because the Prime Minister this week, in a tweet, which remains online, laid out the exact number of houses he wants built and the exact timeline he wants them built on. I am a believer in that everything is possible. Engineers are smart. Like if we tell people to go
smarter
build a thing,
anyway.
They can do math. If we tell someone to go out and build a thing and we offer them the money to do it, I think typically they will figure out a way to make it happen. But let's talk about what it would actually look like. We would have to maintain for about a decade continuously, every year, triple the rate of housing construction that we achieved in our best every year. So or the average of the recent year, somewhere, so don't quote me on that. Someone on Twitter will come after that. But basically, we would have to triple the amount of housing and then sustain it for about a decade. Is that possible? Yeah. Are any of you betting the farm on it? So I think this is what I have found really frustrating about all of this. And you've mentioned Mike Moffitt already. He actually, I think, has the right idea. I've been talking to him about this for a couple of years. Have any of you had to do any home repairs or renovations lately? The cost of getting skilled labor and the wait time to get skilled labor is incredible. My wife, again, who's up in the back hiding... our air conditioner has, we live in an older home, World War II vintage, and our air conditioner broke a few years ago. And what actually broke was the circulating unit in the attic. There's an air pump up there that kind of pulls the cold air and then it trickles throughout the house. We got the replacement unit the next day. Like, you know, the repair guy came, looked at it, said, yep, your attic pump is broken, but we've got one in the warehouse. It'll be here tomorrow. And then he pulled out his phone. He said, let me start making some calls to figure out a work crew. It took 9 days. So what Mike Moffitt has been saying is we're not going to have the skilled labor to build the houses we need the way we used to build them. So what we need to do is cut the actual hours worked per house completed in half. So we get more work out of the same number of laborers here. And again, I think that's fantastic. But I live in a country that does not have enough teachers, does not have enough nurses, does not have enough soldiers, does not have enough personal support workers. Where are we going to get even half the labor supply we think we're going to need? I've always said to folks that I'm a long-term optimist. Regular line readers or viewers will know I'm a Trekkie. Like 300 years from now, I think we're going to be doing amazing. It's the next 50 years I worry about, because the problems we're in, I don't think at this point are problems of will or effort or vision. It's a problem of mathematics. Show me where we will find the people to fix the problems we have.
Well, the problem is that we need more people to fix these problems, but we can't house the people that we need to fix these problems. It's a trap.
The workers can't afford to live in the communities right. They're supposed to be building the houses in.
So how do you resolve this? I don't know how to fix that problem. I do want to move on quickly to talk about pension, and then we're going to stop talking about budgets because I know the budgets are just scintillating,
yeah,
scintillating
talk. Who here loves a little budget talk?
Come on. Give me some energy.
No energy.
Okay, so but this one I do think is going to be a little sexier, and that is during the budget, it was announced that Chrystia Freeland, I believe, was Stephen Pelosi, the former Bank of Canada governor, I believe. Yes? Thank you. I'm drinking. You got to give me a little bit of flack. So I get a little bit of slack here. But essentially, they're going to be creating a working group to talk about reinvesting pension funds back into Canada. And I think that the idea is, especially the CPP being sitting on billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, wants to consider reinvesting that back into Canada. I think that is, I mean, we will see what the outcome of their working group comes up with, and we'll be able to evaluate it more when we see what they write. But that strikes me as batshit crazy. That's batshit crazy. The goal of the, pardon? I'm aware, and that's batshit crazy. The goal of a pension plan is about maximizing returns for the people who use it, in this case, Canadian citizens. That has to be the fundamental goal of a pension plan. And if you have the Canadian pension plan saying, oh, okay, well, we're going to prioritize domestic investment, where do you think that money is going to go? Matt, I'm going to give you a hint. Knowing what you know about Canada, where do you think that money is going to get invested?
The same three ridings in Quebec and Eastern Ontario all the money goes
Thank
to.
Thank you. It's going to be Bombardier, SNC, Air Canada. They'll throw a little money to WestJet to make a point of regional equality. They'll do a little bit. But do you think that money's going back into CNRL and Suncor?
You know,
it's not going to happen. So what you're going to have is you're going to have a CPP that is no longer working for the best interest of all Canadians because it's no longer prioritizing returns. It's prioritizing political favors. Oh, and what do you want to bet that the sorts of companies that get, so I love, Lindsay, that you brought up Quebec. Quebec, notoriously non-corrupt. We all do appreciate that. Yeah. What do you want to bet that the types of companies that get in front of the CPP investors the CPP investors who have this new political mandate are going to be people who have been able to hire within the civil service or lobby within the civil service appropriately in order to get the meetings that are needed in order to make this investment, right? So not only is this...
Government money?
Pardon?
What is government money?
What is government money?
Dumb money.
Correct! $100 for you. So basically, yes, government money is dumb money. So basically, the second you take the priority of this investment out of maximizing returns for all Canadians, right off the bat, you have a system that is going to decrease returns for all Canadians. Because if these companies could provide the best possible returns for Canadians, they wouldn't need a political mandate to do so. They would already be competitive. They would already be domestically competitive. And what that also tells me, no, and this is not, I'm gonna roll now. I got a drink in. What this also tells me is that the reason the people who are lobbying for this are already probably struggling to find capital in the international markets, because the international markets are looking at how they're running their businesses and going, yeah, you're not the best return. So that's why they're leaning on the government in order to try and make these changes happen. And I would say, so bad for all Canadians, bad for Western Canadians in particular, because we all know where that money is going to wind up and how that money is going to wind up being reinvested in Central Canada at the expense of Western Canada and the other provinces. Of course it will, because that's how this country goddamn well works. And then the other thing I would say is that it benefits and creates and disincentivizes further innovation and production. Because if you don't have to compete globally for access to your capital internationally, if you know that you've got easy money coming through your government contacts, you kind of have a luxury to not be as competitive, right?
I think.
Don't get me started.
No, that's right.
Oh, don't get me started. I will need another drink and then I'm really going to get going.
No, that's okay. Someone brought up the issue of journalism being applicable to that, and yes, I agree.
100%.
And I think absolutely. Jen raised a series of points here. I'm going to try to respond to them in sequence. First of all the money flow to Eastern Canada? Yes, but we're really nice guys. Two, on the idea of it kind of all going to the same companies. I don't know how much like local news percolates out to other markets, right? But like, I don't love the idea of redirecting the Canada Pension Plan to the same people who have built the Ottawa LRT, and the gigantic concrete tube under my house that in theory one day will be a subway, and that is years behind schedule. And I think, Jen, I agree with you, what you were saying about the issue of productivity and incentivizing innovation and being, you know, best value for money and all that stuff. But what I would also say is that I just don't think most of the problems we have, some of the problems we have, we need to spend more money on, right? And I think one of the problems that modern conservatism has gotten itself into isn't a focus on spending the money on the right things, it's just a focus on not spending money. And I do think there are things probably we need to be spending more money on. But I look at the systems we have in place right now, and I think to myself, we will not fix them by basically saying, you know what you guys need? Another $100 billion of money that has been legislated to you. Yeah. And what, you know, a lot of you know that I'm a national defense nerd. One of the dirty little secrets, and I'm not even convinced it's that secret anymore, you all know generally the state the Canadian Armed Forces is in. And you all know the fact that we are underfunding it. But what you might not know is that the military normally doesn't spend all the money it's actually budgeted because it can't. The bureaucratic ability doesn't exist. The processes are so slow that billions of dollars lapse every year. And I think about the guys who, either as government bureaucrats or as private sector companies, would be the beneficiaries of this pension money. And I share all of Jen's concerns on a productivity front, but what I really worry about is that we're never going to be able to reform and fix these institutions, and we do need them. We need governments that can effectively spend money. We need private contracting companies that can build stuff. I don't think right now throwing hundreds of billions of extra dollars at them is going to help. I'm actually pretty convinced it will make them worse. And I understand the political appeal of it, which is kind of why I'm amazed they haven't done this already. Like, as Lindsay was saying, Quebec already has. I'm kind of amazed Ottawa has held off even announcing a task force as long as it has. Mm. But it's a really, really, really bad idea.
So the only thing I would say before we go into another Canadian government spending debacle, that's coming, like and subscribe the line, is that for me, if the CPP, now we're still in the very much the if stage. We'll see what the task force comes up with. I don't want to presume the outcome of that, even though I've presumed the outcome of that. But if the CPP goes forward, that changes the math for me on an Alberta pension plan. Big time. Big time. And I'll tell you why, because I was very agnostic about the Alberta pension plan when it was first announced. Like, open to the idea. Show me the numbers. Cool. I'm not emotionally attached to it one way or the other. When the Alberta Task Force came forward and said, well, we're going to take half CPP's assets, $334 billion of assets, I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen. So right off the bat, you're trying to convince me on numbers that I don't think are realistically going to happen. So you kind of lost me there. And I think one of my big fears about an Alberta pension plan was that they were going to do exactly what the CPP is now considering doing, which is reinvesting money back into people who are tangentially connected, the government's buddies, essentially. You're going to have the money going back into the oil sands, which is not necessarily a bad thing if it's a good return on investment, but it was a way to mitigate some of the exodus of capital from that sector that were more focused on climate change initiatives, and it would distort incentives in a really bad way, while at the same time minimizing the return for Albertans, and at the same time it presents all kinds of risks of corruption and insider trading, all kinds of sort of issues like that. But if the CPP is going to do all that anyway, and you have an Alberta pension plan that's coming forward and saying, no, we're going to focus on maximizing investor return. We're not going to throw all that money back into CNRL and Suncor and all of our friends. We're instead going to focus on investor return and maximizing investor return. To me, that makes a real compelling case for an Alberta pension plan in a very new way. So that's just where I'm sitting on this one, but I remain neutral on it.
From the center of the universe on the conditions Jen has laid out, yes.
If the
CPP is going to go down that direction, then Alberta should take whatever it can out of it and run its own system. My challenge to you as a relatively small province population-wise, as Jen has often told me, official Alberta, a relatively small group of people, I'm going to trust you guys to not replicate all the problems Jen is warning about, and there's going to be an obvious political temptation to do that, but if that's the direction the CPP is going down, I can't make a case for you guys staying in it. Only point I'm going to make before we say like and subscribe and move on to the next topic, it was Nirvana, I think, the grunge band, that once said that they knew they had made it when they were spoofed by Weird Al. And Jen, a minute ago, taking that pot shot at Quebec, I'm going to know that we've made it if we get censured by the National Assembly.
It's a goal. We keep on trying, but they never do it.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. All right, Matt, I said arrive can. That was on you. I'm going to drink.
Jen had asked me to kind of recap where we stand on arrive can, but like I'm talking to an audience of Albertans, you probably know more about this than I do already. The development this week, and my mind went in a weird direction. I'm sure a lot of you saw this. It was that one of the contractors who oversaw the company that didn't do the arrive can work, but was like the contract manager, the project manager for it, and billed the government almost $20 million for it. Was called before the House of Commons this week to be admonished.
Yeah, to be called before the bar in the House of Commons, that is a big deal. Like, that is.
But it also sounds like Harry Potter.
Legal system is a little Harry Potter, and we like that about it.
Okay, I'm talking to the Trekkies in the house here. It's like when the Klingons turn their back on you as part of the official shame ceremony.
Correct, that's like, what it's like, it's, yes.
So I thought that was weird.
Weird but appropriate.
Discommendation, they call it. The Klingons, not Ottawa. But I don't honestly know if I have anything in particular to say about this. Like, when the Arrive Can scandal was first breaking, I have a buddy who used to work for a big tech company, and now he's a freelancer. And, you know, he goes on job boards, and it's basically like a business might be like, hey, like, we need an app to help us with some like bespoke inventory management because the commercially available stuff doesn't suit our exact business. And he'll go, okay. And he'll do some Zoom meetings with you, and then he will design an app that will work for the company. It's user-friendly and it's reliable, and he'll build it. So he has some experience with this. And I had said to him, what would you have quoted the government to build the Arrive Can app? And he said, let me look up what it actually did. So he came back to me and he's like, I could probably do this on a long weekend for like $100,000. He goes, I probably obviously would have marked it up to like $500,000, maybe $1 million, because it's the feds and they would pay it, as Lindsay said, dumb money. And also this was in the context of the pandemic when, because of the emergency, we were throwing money at everything. So the guy said to me, I could see how the cost of this would get to $500,000. I could see how the cost of this would get to $1 million. I have no idea how it got more than $50 million. That's just like that's a layer of spending that cannot, to my friend's opinion, and he knows more about this than I do. So basically, this is me covering my ass legally here. I am not accusing anyone of graft, but my friend, who is very intelligent on the matters, could not think of another possible explanation. So I don't know if I have anything more to add about that, but there was one wild card this week that Jen and I spoke.
No, someone's trying to get us in
beer
trouble.
Refill.
Someone has sussed out my 2-drink limit.
Service with a smile.
Take me over it. Oh dear.
See, I told you all before I wanted to bring you home with me for the applause. If Vita keeps bringing me beers mid podcast, Vita, you can come over anytime. Just keep the interesting thing to me about this, and I know this is a wild card diversion from the Arrive Can stuff, because again, I got nothing else to say about that. Like, this reminds me of the $2 million gun registry that cost $1 billion and never worked. But one of the things that came up is that the gentleman who was called before the House to be dishonored in accordance with Canadian and Klingon custom.
What's the weapon?
The bat'leth.
Everyone held up their bat'leth.
And then turned their backs on him. He had presented before committees, and this was also mentioned by his lawyer while he was being admonished, was that he was not able to cooperate fully with the investigation on grounds of mental health, where he had been undergoing treatment for mental health problems.
He had a doctor's note.
And what Jen and I, but before we came on stage tonight, we got to talking about this. I actually find that the more interesting issue on all of this, because...
Well, not more than the $50 million in hypothetical...
The federal government found a way to misplace $50 million, like News at 11. Like, I don't have any particular response to that. Like, I kind of assume that that happens. But what I'm honestly wondering, though, and I've said this to Jen before, I'm a weirdo freelancer now, right? Like, the only person I have to deal with on a day-to-day basis is her. And that's
and
great.
And I am a cruel mistress.
No, she's you're pretty easy to get along with because you're easily distracted.
Don't tell anyone.
Whenever she's mad at me, I just throw a curveball and then I'm in the clear. And
you think that works?
It works for my purposes. I used to manage people, and
I, however, have never been allowed to manage people.
She was one of the people I used to manage, and I can confirm sort that of. She was never asked to manage people. But what would happen is that this was during the era of the so-called Bell Let's Talk, right? We're going to put mental health front and center in the workplace. We're going to take away the stigma. We're going to do all that stuff. And I remember at the time asking my manager, okay, where is the line between reasonable accommodation for someone who is suffering from a genuine mental health problem and the ability to insist on workplace performance standards? And I will do it. Tell me where the line is, and I'll be the good corporate soldier, and I will execute. And what I was saying to Jim before, like, when we started the line, one of the reasons we started it is because we felt something this country...
I was ungovernable and unhireable in any other context. I really do appreciate all of you paid subscribers there.
That was, like, the third reason we started the line.
Number two, at least.
But one of the first ones is because we kind of felt as a society we were in a place where there were not reasonable people who would, in good faith and good conscience, and with all usual Canadian politeness, just go, no, no. We had institutions that couldn't say no. And I want to live in a society that is destigmatizing mental illness. I want to live in a society where we recognize that mental illness is illness and that mental health is health and that where we take good care of our people. But it struck me that we ran into this as a conversation without ever saying, and here are the conditions in which mental health is not going to be an excuse. And I guess we discovered this week that being admonished in the House of Commons is not something where mental health is a get out of free card, which is interesting as a data point. But I don't think like HR managers across the land are deriving any particularly useful benefit from that.
Well, and also...
it's like, well, God. You know, like Mike hasn't shown up in the office in 3 weeks. Well, yeah, but is that like admonishment in the House of Commons worthy, yeah. or do we have to just let that continue?
Let me just say, so this dude, I believe he was part of a company that took, I think, $20
million. It was just under $20
million. Just under $20 million. Okay, so if he had been hospitalized, I'd be willing to cut him some slack. But if you're well enough to put on a suit, show up before the House of Commons, and then pull out the doctor's note, I have some questions. Like, you can't... I got a doctor's note to get out of my day of work at McDonald's. Fine, I don't care. I maybe stole $20 million from the federal government. Doctor's note not going to cover you there, my friend. Sorry.
Are we sure it won't?
In this country, I don't...
No, this is why, and this has been a theme of mine in my writing over the last year. I almost don't care anymore. Like, I'm so emotionally dead inside. I don't care what standard we agree to. Can someone just tell me what it is? Because it just seems to change all the time. Or we have a general vibe that this is the kind of country we want to be, and this is the kind of overall policy we would like to have. And I say, great, so what do I do with this guy? And they go, I don't know.
Do you grant the 5-day leave because his cat died?
So Jen is under the
influence. You're laughing. That's a real story.
No, Jen is under the influence of alcohol, mentioning something I told her off the record. No, it's fine.
Sorry.
Where I am aware of a manager who was asked by an employee if they could have 5 days of bereavement leave because their cat died. And I don't think the employee was taking the piss. Like, I think that the employee was devastated that their cat had died. I'm just saying to you, as a guy who used to manage people in the Let's Talk era, I don't know if that is a reasonable request or not.
And now you know why I never got to manage people.
Yes. So when it comes to admonishment, like, it's... First of all, I shouldn't laugh at this, but being admonished sounds awesome. Like, here I was a minute ago saying we should actually try to get, like, censured by the National Assembly. Like, that's goal one. Parliamentary admonishment is, yes, like, next. Like, correct. That's the real goal.
Hold before the bar?
I don't know. It just seems to me, and this is something I've said to Jen before, one of the problems, if we're to try and diagnose what might have gone wrong in this country...
I'd agree to have the cat stuffed.
What?
Stuff the cat.
Your cat or the other guy's cat?
The guy's cat.
So the guy comes in and says, my cat died and I want bereavement leave.
I'd be
and
like,
you
no.
go, fuck you, I'm stuffing your cat.
Yes.
I'm Matt Gurney, co-founder and HR director of the line.
I'll pay for the taxidermy. There, you can have the cat on your desk. Can you
So Jen cycled through the post-COVID hobbies she had. First it was baking, then it was sewing, and then it was taxidermy.
Hobby.
In fact, mandatory taxidermy. No, I think...
I was saying, no one's pulling that shit on me.
Jen has met my dog once, and it will never happen again. So, one of the things I did, I'm going to try and finish the serious thought. You take a sip. Is, I think one of the reasons we've gotten ourselves into trouble in this country is one of the things that has been allowed to happen, because we're a polite people, is that we have very carefully ground down all the hard edges of large institutions that actually serve accountability functions, because they're unpleasant. Being held to account is unpleasant. Holding your employees to account is unpleasant. So we just don't. And the politicians are distracted, like tweeting each other, and the civil service is basically running itself. Like, how often in this country do we just find out about something like genuinely awful has happened? Like, the example, Jen, I know it's off topic. We talked a little bit in our dispatch last week, but that poor gentleman who died of medical aid and dying after his bed sores.
Yes.
In none of the coverage I read about it, did I ever see anything that, like, there had been an investigation or a finding that maybe that shouldn't have happened. Because things in this country just happen, and then we find out that everyone in a position of authority had no real responsibility of it. I'm going to quote Stephen
King.
That's
why increasingly
from,
Americans look at the stories coming out of America.
We're nuts.
And they think we're nuts.
So my favorite novel is The Stand by Stephen King. And there's a line I can remember for it that I can quote almost verbatim because I think it describes Canada so well. Responsibility was spread in so many directions it became effectively invisible. And I think that's a problem we have in this country, where if you look at a specific failure, you find that no specific person is actually responsible for it. And I think that's how we get ourselves into situations where the only way we can deal with a guy who might have been involved in some degree of graft with federal money is to give him the Klingon shame ritual.
Like and subscribe. Yeah. Take responsibility. Like and subscribe. All right, Matt. We have two different topics on our list. I think both of them will be pithy and fun, or grim. One or the other. One is the role of the Governor General, and the other one is Israel and Iran. I think we should leave it to the audience. Which one do you guys want better?
Okay, when Jen is two drinks in, I think we should remove Israel from the
Look,
list.
I'm a drink and a sip. I'm good. But I'm going to warn you that if you want to go here, we should probably do that first.
I'm saying, you know what I like to do to boost my career? I get drunk and talk about the Middle East.
Great. Good plan. Oh, take it real talk. Real
well,
talk.
Man. No, it's always worth talking about it, and it's easier when you're drunk. It's just, we're still recording, guys. Like, come on. Well, okay, let's actually talk about the Middle East first. When I was heading in, and some of you who have been peeking at your phones, and don't think I don't see the glowing rectangles, guys. I
people
know
are,
when you're
people,
not paying
addicted.
Attention.
They can't help themselves. They
Jen,
have a doctor's note.
I don't know if you saw this, but there actually was a new round of airstrikes.
I did see this.
Just while
yes.
we were getting ready for this.
Which way? To Israel and to Iran, or Iran and Israel?
It was a series of Iraqi military bases that are home to official Iraqi forces that are sponsored by Iran.
Okay.
And a bunch of these bases have mysteriously blown up in the last 90 minutes. So I don't know what to make of that. And for posterity and also for the
Sorry,
audience
because
here,
I'm drunk, are these Iraqi bases or...
They
Israeli
are.
Bases,
these
or?
Are Iraqi military facilities inside Iraq, home to Iraqi forces that are backed by Iran.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that could be Israel striking the Iran.
I can't think of anyone else who would.
Oh, okay, great.
But also, I mean, who knows? So what Jen and I have been worried about since October 7th, and obviously October 7th was horrific on its own, and obviously... Jen and I have always made the point, we're not immune to the human suffering that's been happening in Gaza as the Israeli retaliation continues. But as Jen and I have often said, there is no line of writing that I can put in a dispatch or that she can say in a podcast that's going to fix the Middle East. That's not pressure we put on ourselves. Like, it's not up to us to craft the perfect message to bring peace to the Holy Land. Our concern has been, as much as possible, how is this playing out on the home front? How is this dividing our own communities? What is the threat and the risk to different communities here? And this has cut both ways. You know, I am very much aware of the concerns of the Jewish community, and I'm also very much aware of the concerns of the Muslim community, because I think the first incident of violence in North America that was linked to the event of October 7th was when a young Muslim boy was killed by his landlord. That was just outside Chicago. So I'm not insensitive to these concerns, but the thing that has made me the most worried has been the prospect of escalation, of this getting worse. And, you know, Jen and I had joked a couple of years ago. Remember when we were talking about UFOs all the time? That was great.
Yeah, I really want to go back to talking about UFOs.
UFOs are amazing.
I'm into it.
But one of the things that Jen and I had talked about was, like, this is in the middle of the pandemic and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It was like, aliens, not now. Like, no, we're busy. Like, this is not a good time for you to come here.
That's why the government rolled back their long-term communication
hit the pause
strategy.
Button on that one.
Yeah,
I kind of felt the same way about like the Middle East descending into a further regional catastrophe. Now would not be a good time for the Middle East to explode. Like, can we take a rain check in 12 months and like see how we're doing then? I actually am a little bit more optimistic, unless one of you has a phone right now and can tell me that what happened in Iraq 2 hours ago is the balloon going up and now we're in deep shit. Like, actually, I woke up this morning thinking to myself, the Israeli strike in Iran last night was limited. The Iranians seem to be handling it in a way that suggests they are inclined to de-escalate. And I actually felt a little bit better about this than I had in about a week. And then I go to the bathroom so that I don't have to pee while we're recording this podcast. And I make the mistake of looking at my phone and there's more airstrikes in the Middle East. So I feel like for the last 2 years since the Russians invaded Ukraine, we've all been living on the brink of some of the weird scenarios.
We're in the bad timeline.
We are in the bad timeline.
This is the bad timeline. Okay, so here's what I would say is that I think you and I are broadly aligned. We're a Canadian commentary bunch of shit-posting dilettantes. Like we don't really, we're fun.
That was the original motto.
That was, that's what we're going to put underneath our subscribe now, like and subscribe. Our focus is on Canadian politics, and to the extent that we talk about or analyze what's going on in the Middle East, it's always with an eye to how that affects us here at home. It's what does this vote on the Gaza ceasefire mean for the Canadian conversation? What is Melanie Jolie, what does her comments have to say about any of this? This is, you know, to some extent, what's going to play out in the Middle East is the result of a 75-year/3,000-year conflict. It's going to play out as it is. Nothing Matt and I say or believe about any of it is going to make a lick of difference. And I think, frankly, very little of anything that Canada does is going to make a lick of difference for any of it. So my position has always been, I think there's a really, really wide range of views, of acceptable viewpoints in terms of where you stand on the Israel versus the Palestine or the two-state solution or whether or not that's viable. I'm pretty neutral on a lot of that stuff. I think there's reasonable arguments one can have on a lot of that stuff. Where I get my hackles up is where I see people targeting, you know, local Jewish communities because they're angry about what Benjamin Netanyahu has done. That's where I go, yeah, no, that ain't ball. Or when I see, for example, I mean, I wrote a fairly nasty column about Jody Gondek's decision not to attend the menorah lighting ceremony. I'm like, that is a breach of a kind of social contract to demonstrate sort of a community-first Canadianist, pan-Canadian alliance to all different kinds of diaspora communities. And that was what irked me about that. So, anyway, you and I both have a very Canadian perspective on this. We're rooted in a Canadian perspective on this. And I think you and I both accept there's a broad range of views that people can have on this. And I think you and I were both very emotionally affected by October 7th. You probably more than I did because you viewed a lot of the videos that we both agreed that would probably not be best for me to view simply because I have got young children now and my emotional ability to tolerate some of that stuff is not what it was even 10 years ago. That's just the reality, right? So I was kind of, how should I say this? whether or not Israel's role in Gaza is appropriate or not appropriate, or what kind of tactics they're using is appropriate or not appropriate. Again, wide range of views are acceptable. I don't make a hard stand on that. But when I saw Israel sort of bombing the, not the embassy, but the diplomatic compound in Syria, to me, I went, okay, that's an escalation. Check, please. Like, we're now moving outside the realm of some kind of grounded warfare that is about destroying Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and we're now into a state where we're escalating, and we're escalating into a space that now risks a serious regional conflict. And I don't know what the end goal here. I don't see what the end state is, and that really concerns me, because now it makes me feel like you've got two people who are playing chicken with each other, and I'm not convinced that there are adults in either of these rooms.
I am going to, in the next 30 seconds, completely charm this audience. They're going to be putty in my hands.
You're very good at that.
Let's talk Cold War game theory.
All right.
Yeah. You know, one of the most dangerous situations that you can be in, whether it's in a specific context of the Cold War, as I was saying a minute ago, or any game theory application in general, is when you have two parties and they both think the other bastard's escalating. And Jen has said, and I don't disagree, that when Israel hit the diplomatic compound in Damascus and killed some senior Iranian officials, that was an escalation in the sense that that was new. That was something we hadn't seen before. It was Israel doing a thing it had previously not been willing to do. Israel has killed no shortage of Iranian officers, but they hadn't bombed a diplomatic compound before. I stipulate the point. That's escalatory. But I also know, and this is something that I've been trying to say since October 7th, Israel doesn't agree with that. And Israel thinks that October 7th was the escalation, that they have spent 30 years, an entire generation, surrounded by Iranian-backed, armed, trained, and financed terror groups that are beyond the point of what we would think of as terrorism and the fact that a guy gets on a bus with a suicide vest. We're getting to the point where some of these terror groups are effectively light infantry brigades. These guys operate as organized military units. And when as Jen said, I did watch the footage of the October 7th attacks, and for whatever reason, I'm broken in a way or trained in a way that even though I was seeing the horror of it, I was also observing the way that these guys moved, communicated, coordinated, and use their weapons. They were trained. Israel now exists in a place, and look, I don't say this in any way to excuse them. Allowing October 7th to happen was an unforgivable fuck up on the part of the Israelis. And I say this as a guy who is resolutely pro-Israel, always has been. But I have said this directly to Israeli senior military officers I've spoken to. When this is over, if and when, you have to answer for this. And the saddest story of October 7th that I've heard that speaks to this point was a community that held out for 7 hours until they ran out of ammunition. And then they were overrun and massacred. How do you in your own country, when you're one of the most heavily armed and defended countries in the world, allow a community in your own territory to not have relief in 7 hours? Heads have to roll. There's no excuse for that. Careers need to end, and probably people need to go to prison. But I think something that we don't understand, and I have tried to write this probably about a dozen times, is that our understanding of this is rooted in the North American perspective of, oh, this thing happens, and then we get distracted because, hey, the playoffs are starting. And then another thing happens, and we're all focused on that for a couple of days. And then, you know, Justin Trudeau has a bad tweet, and then we're focused on that. And then some other horrible humanitarian disaster happens, but then Sydney Sweeney goes on SNL, and wow, she looks good. And we keep getting distracted. The Israelis don't. This is, for them, 30 years of continuity. And what happened to them on October 7th does not exist outside the context for them the last 30 years. And I don't think them bombing Damascus exists outside that context
either.
Yeah,
but by bombing Damascus, they're escalating this from a proxy war to a potentially a high-risk act of war with a regional power directly.
I think after October 7th, when you have 3,000 armed effectives overrun your southern border, you might conclude that what you've been trying isn't working.
As a result of your own intelligence failures.
Absolutely, as a result
I can understand. I'm not naive or pacifistic about the need for a military force. I understand that there's a need for military force. But I do need to see military force that's rooted in something resembling a strategic end. I don't see engaging in this weird kabuki theater of like tit for tat between Israel and Iran directly is leading to a strategic end where Israel lives happily ever after. Israel's not going to get rid of Iran. That's not going away.
No, but certain people in Iran may turn on their car one day and then they will go away.
Yes, some of them are.
And I think, you know, it was something that happened. I don't know how much coverage this got in the immediate aftermath of October 7th because of all of that. But one of the things that if you were reading the papers closely is that the Israelis have stood up a unit of their intelligence services whose purpose it will be to Munich style. I think a lot of you would have seen the movie Munich, or you would have read the book by the late George Jonas. They're going to spend the rest of eternity hunting down the people who are responsible for this. But I think what part of what we're seeing Israel do is signal specifically to the Iranians, you are not untouchable. And we're done blowing up some of your proxies every couple of months to send a message. From now on, it's going to be you. That you're not wrong that that's escalatory. But again, I would say if you don't appreciate that the Israelis view that as a response and not an escalation, you're not going to understand what's happening.
And I would say if the Israelis don't understand that everyone else is perceiving it as an escalation, they're going to risk losing global support and damn quick.
I honestly think perhaps the thing that changed the most in the last 6 months is that Israel don't give a fuck.
Well, then they're going to be increasingly isolated, and good luck.
They don't give a fuck.
Well, okay, like, fair enough. If that's the strategic thing they're going to, but increasingly this is starting to feel like the war on terror. If we invade another country, if we kill another group of people, if we do another bombing, if we do another blah, 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 that'll fix the terrorism problem.
You know what the difference is, though? When we lost the war on terror, we came home. We got everybody in the planes and flew back.
What does losing the war on terror look like for Israel? So maybe just be a little cautious about what kind of war you want to wage here. The population of Iran is 100 million to Israel's what?
A little less than 100 million, but it's about a 10-to-1 Iranian advantage.
Yeah, and how dependent is Israel on Western support? That support goes away tomorrow. What does that look like for Israel?
If that support goes away tomorrow, I think the question is more what that looks like for the rest of the Middle East.
Yes, true. I agree.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, look, this is not... Israel can't bomb its way out of its existential problems here. I'm just not convinced of that, and I don't see a clear strategic goal here that makes sense for me anymore.
I'm not convinced they do either, but
well,
that
seems like a problem.
Oh, it's absolutely a problem. But I mean, like the cute little aphorism we've often used to describe the Middle East to talk about Israel is like nice house in a bad neighborhood. That's often what we've said, right? And if you're living in that bad neighborhood and you've got nowhere else to go and you're convinced you're going to die, your calculus changes. You know, like I said a few minutes ago, guys, like I'm an optimist on a 300-year time horizon. I don't disagree with anything you're saying right now, and that's why my optimism tends to kick in about three centuries out.
That's wise.
You know, I do think the only thing I ask for on this is, and I'm not asking anyone to agree with me on Israeli policy, but I do think if you don't understand that their calculus has changed, you're going to spend the next few years being constantly surprised.
I understand and respect their calculus, and I can even empathize with their emotional state, but that's not a strategy. That's not an end game.
If I had a strategy to give them that I thought I would work, I would.
Well, I've got a few ideas. Maybe I can put me in there.
We'll save that for the written pod.
Save that for the written dispatch. So,
we're having a good time. We've really raised the mood.
Mood. There we go. So is there anything funny we want to end off
with? What was the last topic on our list?
I mean, the last topic was the inappropriate use of Rideau Hall and the Governor General on Online Harms Act. Does anybody want to say, shall we just go to the off-the-record
that
Q&A?
Is marginally less depressing than the Middle East.
And certainly more insoluble. So there you go.
We've been talking just over an hour.
My God.
Time flies when you're drinking and talking about existential religious struggle.
That's fine.
Okay, we can do one more.
Do you want to move to the Q&A? One more? One more? All right.
All right. Give us that was a mixed vote. Give us a cheer for one more. All right.
right, give us a cheer for off the record Q&A.
Yeah, who has the guts to speak out against that, Rosen? All right, one weirdo.
Okay, we'll also do the offer. Okay, so we do want to talk.
We will, but we'll do. Yeah, we'll do.
Okay,
this
so
first.
Let's talk the Governor General. Do you want to take lead on this one?
I mean, no, because it makes me sad.
That's never stopped you before.
You know, Jen, and so the context of this, and I think all of you know this, but I have to recap it in case you don't, is that there was an event this week at the Governor General's official residence where a variety of people came up to talk about the issue of online harassment and abuse. This is a problem that Jen and I have written about and that we agree it's a real problem. And I used to work with a woman who some of you will know now, and she remains a close friend. Her name is Supriya Dwivedi, and she now works in the Prime Minister's office. When she and I worked in the media together, she would show me the emails she was getting in real time. Like, she would turn her computer screen and show them to me. I would get, like, I would publish a column or I would say something on the radio, and someone would email me, "Gurney, you bald loser, fuck you." And I'd go, well, another happy fan, right? Like, Supriya would say something less controversial, and people would send her graphic descriptions of exactly how they would murder her. And something that Jen and I have talked about before, and I think you came up with a really good way of describing it, was you said that online anonymity is an opportunity for a certain kind of twisted man to vent their frustration. And the target is almost always women.
Well, I mean, I would even say to a lesser extent, we get the same thing on Twitter, and it's very funny because you'll make a fairly sedate comment about whatever policy, and then I'll make the slightly spicier version of basically the same argument, and I get nothing but hate. And you're like, "Mr. Gurney, have you reconsidered your position?" Like, exactly. It's totally different. It's very funny.
I cannot fully agree with Mr. Gurney's stated views. And then Jen goes, "Yeah, I kind of agree with Matt." And people go, "You bitch!" Like, it is lopsided.
Monster.
Now, I do think, and this is something, I don't say this to be woke, and I don't think I'm not often accused of that, I think it gets worse if you are a woman or a member of a visible minority. I think that does draw out more of the hate. So, I don't have an objection to any kind of public meeting on the topic of online abuse. I think we should be spending more time and energy on this. And I've mentioned my poor wife hiding somewhere in the back. She's an elementary school teacher, and she has been able to tell me, and this is not yet in the realm of social media, but cyberbullying is an issue at an incredibly young age. You know, I'm sure a lot of you in the audience would have had, like, good years in school and bad years of school. Grade 5 for me was a bad year. I was picked on by older kids for most of the entire year. But at 3:00, when the bell went, I got to go home. I had a safe refuge to go to. I had a safe place. The cyberbullying just follows you. So I have all kind of sympathy for the idea of commissioning a panel or a task force or something like that. But you can't have it be the Governor General.
And why can't you have it be the Governor General?
Because there's legislation before the House right now on this very issue. And it is just irreconcilable to have the Governor General raising a profile of an issue that is politically controversial.
And why is that?
I think I just said so. I don't know how else.
Because the Governor General has an obligation
to be
politically neutral.
And is
literally, this is their role. They serve as a representative of the king or queen in the country, and their job is to be totally and beyond question apolitical and beyond partisanship. Because there are rare circumstances in which a Governor General will have to decide to, say, dissolve a government. Right, so they cannot be perceived in any way to be sympathetic to one party or the next. They have to be beyond reproach.
I'm not the only one who heard a duck quacking a minute ago.
I also heard a duck quacking.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm not taking it personally.
Okay, so Alberta has no rats, but there's a duck in the theater. Okay, great.
That's fine.
I said almost at the beginning of the podcast, one of the problems we have is that we race to maximally stupid positions on almost every issue. And I don't understand why people are struggling to balance these two radically complicated thoughts, that there should be a summit on online abuse and that it should not be hosted by the Governor General.
No, it's inappropriate, especially considering in this case the Justice Minister, Arie Fureni, appeared at the summit, didn't speak at it, appeared at it, and then put out tweets about how they discuss the Online Harms Act, Bill C-63, and we all know that the Online Harms Act has been considerably controversial.
By doing that, it's implicit that the Governor General and the institution, the Office of the Governor General, has supported their efforts.
And the perception is there, even if the reality isn't. And pointing this out has even been deemed controversial in some quarters, and I think that's horrendously inappropriate. So I just would like to put our little hat in the ring and note that I think it's pretty obviously it was a misstep in the decision making of Mary Simon here. I do think that it stepped into a line of perceived partisan affiliation here, and it shouldn't have happened. It just shouldn't have happened.
And I also think I was saying to Jen before, just we had coffee before we did this, just to plan out our list of topics in her illegible handwriting, and one of the things we talked about was how 2 years ago, as an aside, in one of our written dispatches, I think we struck upon the answer that we still stick to. If you want to get serious about online harassment, online abuse, cyber stalking, cyber bullying, all you need is what I said we needed a few minutes ago. We just need to get the accountability mechanisms working again. When it is actually rising to the level of criminal harassment or criminal threats, threats of bodily harm, threats of violence, threats of murder, the cops got to deal with that. And I am incredibly sympathetic to the fact that the Canadian police are slow to respond to these issues. And either, I don't know if that's out of apathy or out of overwork and being overburdened. I honestly don't. But there is no piece of legislation that makes these problems go away. There is no filter on a social media app that makes these problems go away. A few of these guys get arrested and get their mugshots published in the local paper. That might start to turn things around, and even if it doesn't, they won't be tweeting anymore. Some of these problems we have are only going to be solved when the police treat crimes like crimes.
Well, and again, I think we should also just make clear, we're not just talking about mean tweets or people being mean to me or being mean to Matt. We're quite indifferent to that. We have no soul or feelings anymore. We're talking about threats of murder.
I did once.
Here.
Yeah.
You did have a soul once.
Once.
And the industry destroyed it. I mean, I can tell you the one story of my own adventures with criminal harassment, and we're not talking mean tweets here. We're talking clear threats to life and limb. That's not a free speech issue. That's criminal harassment over the line, no question. That's what we're discussing here, and I think that there have been certainly in certain parts of the country, many female journalists in particular have made the point they've gone to the police with clear cases of criminal harassment and they've not been taken seriously. That's personally not been my experience here in Calgary. I think that, once again, Calgary's fantastic. Calgary. The police here have taken those threats very seriously, and I've always felt very protected. But I think that in some parts of the country, that's less true.
I would not put move to Calgary, we take your cyber abuse seriously, on the top of the list of the next ad campaign.
But what about the rats?
In a pinch, it could do. Ladies, gentlemen, as we said before, we will move to an off-the-record Q&A session now. We've been gabbing for a little bit over an hour. We got about an hour, 45 minutes, an hour to kill here. And if you guys run out of questions, we're happy to get down there and mingle with
we'll have
some popcorn. Because the popcorn smells really good.
It does sound good. We can't eat that.
I know, it's ridiculous to be doing a podcast and you're munching it.
It's not going to fly.
But so, I did the intro remarks. Would you like to do the concluding remarks?
What do I have to say for the concluding remarks? Thank
the sponsor.
Oh, thank you, the sponsor. Yeah, all right. DS Lawyers. Hello, DS Lawyers. Meet Lindsay in our crowd. If you are interested in, if you need a lawyer, business law. Yes, they're actually really fantastic. And like I said, if you are coming to our meet and greet, we will tell you the terrible story of how Lindsay was our wonderful evil savior. They're fantastic. We love them dearly. But if you have any business law needs, please do connect with them. We recommend them highly. And also, I want to just give an enormous thank. Oh, you know, can I give a couple of thanks out for this? This is our first live.
No.
This is our first live taping. And I haven't ruled out that it's a disaster because I haven't heard the actual file yet. We're very MacGyvering this. But there's a couple people I do want to thank because this is going to be probably the last time we have a couple of people in the same room. One, your wife. B, my husband, and C, probably my father. I mean, I'm presuming that my husband and my father are here because they were supposed to be, but if they're not, I'm going to make an ass of myself.
They're in the bar.
Oh, Alex, oh, fantastic. So firstly, I just want to say, and he's going to hate this because he hates being singled out in every way. He likes being a dark creature in the corner. But I think Caitlin Moran said that the type of life that you lead will be severely curtailed or determined by the type of husband that you have if you're a woman. And that's true. I've never known anything that was more true. I was very lucky at 28 to meet the man who would turn out to be my husband. And I had lucky because I had no idea that he would turn out to be so well. I mean, he was a bit of a work in progress, but he really came through for me. but no, I mean, the kind of life that I've been able to have, the children that I've been able to have, the career that I've been able to have, is almost entirely dependent on the fact that I've had a solid, supportive partner who encouraged me to rage quit when it was appropriate to rage quit and has absolutely backed me up through every batshit crazy idea that I've had up to, including starting the line and beginning to learn how to sew and doing crazy cake pastry stuff. He is like my hero. He's my champion on all this stuff, and I couldn't possibly have been even half as successful unless I had the type of partner that I did. So while he's in the room, I'm going to give him an opportunity to get applause that he'll hate because he's awesome. So please applaud my husband. Thank you, although he's not standing up. And also, I'm going to say give a big thanks to Kira as well, your wife, who I think has been just lovely and glorious. And again, without her support, I don't think that we could start the line together. So, like, our spouses are amazing.
I didn't know we were thanking the spouses. Oh, I'm not ready for this.
Oh, come on. Like, I just set the bar, man.
Jen just completely ambushes me at that. Matt, I'd just like to take a minute to just say these wonderful things about my husband, and I don't even know where in the audience my wife is. It's like, wherever you are, babe, like great work. my wife and I have known each other a long time. We actually went to high school together, and people always go, aw, no, we weren't dating in high school. We knew each other in high school. The fun stuff came later. But one of the things I can easily say about my wife, because it's something I do think about every day, and I've mentioned the start of the pandemic already, one of my friends is a family lawyer. And when the pandemic began, something she told me was that every marriage that was marginal in this country was going to fail in the next 12 months. Mm-hmm. And probably it was around the first week of lockdown when it occurred to me one day that I had married well. And it was simply that I wasn't loving the experience of being confined in my house. It left something to be desired, but I wouldn't have wanted to be doing it alone, and I couldn't think of anyone else I would rather have done it with, who isn't fictional. So
he's got a thing for the Klingons.
I don't. No, the Klingons are not my kind. But what I would honestly say is, if you want to get the measure of my wife's devotion, is I said to her, "Do you want to come to Calgary and watch us record a podcast?" And she went, "Okay." This is, I am extremely confident, is the first The Line podcast she has ever listened to, and she is literally captive in the room. So it is important to marry well. It is important to marry people you are compatible with. I thought in my case it was important to marry someone who was not as obsessed with the news as I was, because I didn't think that would be healthy. So I ended up leaning in the opposite direction. So I appreciate the fact not only that she flew out here and also arranged for her parents to come to our house in Toronto and look after the kids, but also that she has probably spent the last hour and 10 minutes or so bored out of her mind. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is another language of love. So to my wife, my thanks. Please, give her a kiss. I was about to say I love you when the applause started, so I feel I love you. You may now applaud again, please. Yeah, thank you.
I also would like to thank my dad for coming all the way out here. For anybody who is very confused about me as a human being, just meet my father. Much will be explained. I take after him. And also, most importantly, I just wanted to thank everybody who came out today. This is actually so crazy that 150 people paid $20 to see us talk. That blows my mind. You guys are our core subscribers, and honestly, without you, we couldn't be successful at what we do. So it's makes me a little verklempt, but I'm not going to show it. I'm going to drink a drink instead. But thank you so much for showing up, and again, thank you for supporting The Line. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Thank you for reading our newsletter. We appreciate it so much.